Welcome for part two, Shuli. A pleasure to have you back. And to Yavne, I think we're going over to Yavne a little bit. Rabbi Akiva, the Bar Kochba revolt, and Vakasha, round two.
Okay, hi everybody. Welcome. So today we are going to continue. Last week we did the first generation post-Churban, the time of the ending of the time of the temple, the time of the destruction, and the recovering afterwards. And we focused on Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabban Gamliel. Today we're going to start off a little bit in the second generation, Rabbi Yoshua, and his challenges, but we're going to spend the most of our time talking about Rabbi Akiva and the Bar Kochba revolt. So just to remind us, in terms of, we won't look at a timeline this time, but basically what we are talking about are the early years. Everybody please mute themselves, or maybe Rabbi Kalman mute everybody. We are talking about the early years of the second century of the Common Era. The revolt itself, we date to 132 to 135 of the Common Era. We're going to talk a little bit about the years before, the years after, but that's the basic time frame that we are talking about. So let's go to the pictures and see what we can learn. All right. Okay, so we're going to be talking, like I said, largely about the Bar Kochba revolt, the personalities involved. Of course, Rabbi Akiva, who is one of the major personalities, one of the major personalities in Judaism in general. If you had to pick your top 10, 15 Jews, Rabbi Akiva makes the list. We're really only going to be scratching the surface of all there is to learn about Rabbi Akiva. It's hard to find an area of Torah that Rabbi Akiva was not involved in, but we're going to talk about him with this emphasis on the historical time period. We're also going to talk about the historical figure of Bar Kochba, what we know about him, the Roman and the revolt all together. What you are looking at, and we're going to see other pictures like this as we go on, is the entrance to a hideout cave. Okay? This is actually a place called Chir Bet Midras, not too far from Beit Shemesh. And that's going to be a large part of our story of understanding the Bar Kochba revolt through archaeology. But we're not there quite yet. We have a few things we want to do before that we want to go back to from last week. Okay, so last time we talked mostly about Yavne, but that does not mean that these were the only important cities at the time, okay? And we hear about other places as well. This is before we make the move up to the Galil. That's going to be next week. We're going to talk about that. But we are still in what the Gemara often calls Daroma, right? The south. It's not really the south. Today we would call it the center, okay? But we have other sites as well as Yavne. So let's talk for a minute about Lud and Bnei Brak. Okay, so let's just find this on my map that is much too big. Okay, so here's Ben Gurion Airport, right? Lud is now being covered up at the moment by what I have here from you guys, right? But Lud right here near the airport, okay? And Bnei Brak, this is modern Bnei Brak, okay? But we're going to see that the tell of Bnei Brak is actually here, by Ariel Sharon Park, okay? Not very much, well here, sorry, I did Lud wrong. I don't know why I did that, sorry. Here's Lud, okay, forget that. And here's Bnei Brak. Lud, we're gonna see, does have some archaeology. Bnei Brak, very much an unknown. They are very significant sites that we hear about in various places in the Mishnah and the Gemara. Who's living in these places? Rabbi Akiva, first of all, has his Beit Midrash in Bnei Brak. Rabbi Yossi Haglili, his contemporary, Rabbi Tarfon, very, very wealthy. Rabbi Elezer ben Hyrcanus, okay? Living in Lud, living in Bnei Brak, traveling between those places just to get a sense of proportions. Here's Yavne. Okay, so none of these places are particularly far from each other, and they are all outside of Jerusalem. Just two examples of important sources and people who, I don't know how we distributed the sources, but you should have source sheets if you want to look at them instead of only looking on the PowerPoint. We have a few important sayings that we know that come from these places. So for example, the top source over here, Rabbi Yochanan said in the name of Rabbi Shimon ben Yotzadak, the sages who discussed this issue counted the votes of those assembled and concluded in the upper story of the house of Nitza in the city of Lud. Okay, who is this Nitza? We don't know, but it's someone who made his home, or her home, probably his, a Beit Vad l'Chachamim, right? A place for the Chachamim to gather. And they come up with a very important decision that we're going to reference a little later when we get to the story of the Bar Kokhba revolt, because this is very relevant, and that's why people are talking about it. With regard to all the transgressions in the Torah, if a person is told, transgress this prohibition, you will not be killed, he may transgress and not be killed, except for idol worship, forbidden sexual relations, and bloodshed, right? The three big ones. Famous Gemara in Sanhedrin. We'll talk about that, but the important thing for us is a decision is taken in the city of Lod. Okay, Bnei Brak, Pesach coming up. I know none of us likes to think about that, but it's coming up very soon, right? And we all know, remember the famous paragraph in the Haggadah that's taking place in Bnei Brak. It happened on Pesach that Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Eliezer, Ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon, right? The stars, right? The most important people of their generation are sitting together having a Seder as the star-studded Seder, reclining in Bnei Brak and telling the story of the Exodus from Egypt that whole night until their students came and said to them, the time of reciting the Shema has arrived. Okay, so that's Bnei Brak and Lud, and we're going to take a little bit of a closer look at both of them for a moment. Okay, Lud, we know from references in the Gemara, Lud was a wealthy city. Okay? It had a lot of synagogues. It had a lot of wealthy people who lived there. Okay? Rabbi Tarfon, we know, is very wealthy, and others as well. It doesn't stay wealthy, but certainly in the time of the Mishnah, it's a very wealthy place. And here's something fascinating. In 1996, doing road construction in Lud, which if you know a little about Israel, is not a particularly high class or wealthy place at all. It's a very working class town. When they were doing road construction, they came across this unbelievable mosaic floor. You really don't get a sense of how incredible it really is. It's one of the most intact mosaic floors from this time period, right? From the Roman time period, late third, early fourth century. Gorgeous, gorgeous. This is not reconstructed in any way. This is what it looks like. Okay. And it was carefully taken out. It actually went on a round the world trip. I remember when it was discovered, I was in tour guide school and it was exposed to the public for like 2 days and we went to go see it. And then that's it. It left. It went to the Met. It went to Italy. It went to all different places. Now it's coming back here and they are building a center for it. Leon Levy, Alav Shalom, and his wife, Shelby White, Tibadel Chaim, they're very into archaeology. They're building a center in Lod just for this mosaic. And it gives you a sense this is not a Jewish, I mean, there's no reason to assume that it's a Jewish home. There's nothing Jewish about it. There's nothing Christian about it either. It could be a Christian, a Jew, a pagan, but it's definitely someone who has a lot of money, has a lot of interesting exotic animals. But one of the things that's fascinating is not so pretty, but it's interesting. Take a look on the left. When they were taking out the mosaic, which is not such a simple thing to do, they discovered in the layer underneath the layer of the mosaic, a footprint, right? Can you see that's a footprint? This is the workers who were making the mosaic. And the footprint got caught, and here it is, 1,800 years later. It's pretty wild. Okay, here's another scene from it. And Lud does well in the time of the Mishnah, but as we're going to see in the next session that we do, Jews leave Lud, leave Judea in general, move up to the north. Money also leaves Lod. It's not a wealthy city anymore. We even have this source that talks about 10 measures of poverty. 9 of them are in Lod. So it's really going from a very high place to a very low place. And in terms of Torah as well, here we had this center of Torah where you have people like Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon, and Rabbi Elazar ben Harkana sitting around together, and suddenly there's nobody there. And that's where we get this very interesting story. If you're doing Daf Yomi, you came across this story not so long ago, a few weeks ago. Rabbi Simlai came to Rabbi Yochanan, right? Rabbi Yochanan is famous, lives in Tveria, right? Famous Amora living in the Tiberias. This is many generations after Rabbi Akiva. He said to him, would the master teach me the book of genealogies? Rabbi Yochanan said to him, where are you from? He said to him, I'm from Lod. Rabbi Yochanan said, and where are you presently living? He said, in Naharda'a. Rabbi Yochanan said, I have a tradition that we teach these subjects neither to Lodites nor to Nahardaans, and certainly not to you who comes from Lod and your residence is in Naharda. It's kind of a rude answer, right? It's not very nice. And in the Yerushalmi, in the version of this in the Yerushalmi, he says, I don't teach any of these things to Southerners because they are gasei ruach. They don't appreciate the finer things in life. And it's a little bit strange because Rabbi Simlai is not a gas ruach. He's somebody who knows a lot about Midrash and about Torah Shabbat Peh. What does Rabbi Yochanan have against him? And it seems Rabbi Yochanan is a booster of the Galil. The Galil, the north, is what's important now. Don't tell me about your community in Lod. I'm not interested. That's not a place of Torah anymore. Okay, so that's just a little bit of a look at Lod. Hopefully more things will be discovered there. That would be very exciting. Okay, Bnei Brak is even worse shape because Bnei Brak is essentially very inaccessible today. It's not inaccessible, but it has not been excavated. In the early part of the 20th century, people came and settled in a place that's a little bit north of the original Bnei Brak. How do we know it's the original Bnei Brak? Because this was an Arab village called Ibn Ibrak. That's pretty close. Okay. So you had modern Bnei Brak, but then a few kilometers to the south of it, you had this site, which was turned into an enormous, enormous garbage dump, right, called Khiria. And you couldn't drive along the highway going to Tel Aviv without, you still can't, without seeing this massive thing, right? But what happened was that about 10, 15 years ago, I decided to put some money into it and take this dump Khiria and turn it into an ecological park named after Ariel Sharon. Very nice. But here, take a look, here on the very edge of the park is Bnei Brak HaKtuma, the ancient Bnei Brak, in the middle of this park that's essentially made out of garbage. Okay, so there was a little bit of excavation that was done there, but really nothing very serious. We have finds that go from the Ottoman period all the way back to the biblical period, but nothing particularly impressive or beautiful. One of the things that's kind of neat, though, is that when you're driving on route number 4 and you see Khiria, where do you see it? You are right at a highway intersection that is called Machlef Misubin, the Misubim intersection. Why? Because Rabbi Akiva and all his friends were Misubim b'Bnei Brak. They were reclining in Bnei Brak. So this is one of those nice little things that the Vadat Shemot, the Names Commission in Israel, loves to remind us of, you know, our heritage and where things came from. And that's always fun to see. But in terms of what there is in Bnei Brak, unfortunately, as of now, very, very little. Okay, we're going to move from Bnei Brak to a personality who we really could spend an awful lot of time on. We're not going to spend too much time, but interesting to mention, and this is the second generation, okay? This is Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananya, the student of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, the contemporary of Rabbi Elazar ben Horkanus, and the teacher with Rabbi Elazar of Rabbi Akiva, okay? So he's second generation, student of Rabban Yochanan, teacher of Rabbi Akiva. He's also this transitional generation, meaning he already was living when the temple is standing. And in fact, he's a Levi. Okay, we'll see that in some of the sources that we have here. He has a personal experience of the temple, but he also lives through the destruction. And he's understanding of the importance of the temple, but he's also understanding that life has to go on. He's very moderate, both in his politics and in his halakha. Often he's the lenient voice. He's described, Pirkei Avot tells us, right, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's 5 students, and each one has something special about him. Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananya, Ashrei Yoldato, blessed is or happy is the one who gave birth to him. And there's a great story in the Gemara that talks about how his mother would bring him as a baby in his baby carriage to the Beit Midrash so that he could hear the scholars studying, and this would give him, you know, already as an infant, you know, like they play baby Mozart, right? This would give him a love for Torah, and it seems to have worked. Okay, so we have a few a few sources that mention Rabbi Yeshua as a Levi in the temple. I brought you the picture of the instruments in the temple because of this first source here, Gemara and Arachin. There was an incident involving Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania, a Levi, who went to Rabbi Yochanan ben Gudgoda, also a Levi, in order to assist in closing the doors of the temple. And if you recall, the Leviim in the temple had two jobs. One was to sing and to play instruments, but what if you weren't so talented? You were a schlepper, okay? You closed the doors, you schlepped things, that's what you did. And Rabbi Yeshua is going to help close the door. Rabbi Yochanan ben Gudgoda said to him, "My son, go back, as you are among the singers and not among the gatekeepers." It sounds much better in Hebrew. You are from the Mishorim and not the Shoarim, right? So you are lucky, you have a good voice. You don't have to be a schlepper. That's not your job, okay? Then we have this other great eyewitness account that Rabbi Yeshua gives of what it was like in the temple on Sukkot, right? We had all the partying on the middle days of Sukkot, the Simchat Beit HaShoeva, right? The celebration of the water, the drawing of the water. He said we would rejoice in the celebration of the place of the drawing of the water. We did not see sleep the entire festival. How so? In the first hour of the day, the daily morning offering was sacrificed, right? He was there for the tamid, for the first sacrifices of the day. Then they proceeded to prayer in the synagogue, then to the sacrifice of the musaf, the additional offerings, then to the synagogue to recite the prayer, right? Very interesting, by the way, because Rabbi Yeshua is telling us, not like what we often think, that there are sacrifices, and when there are no more sacrifices, there's prayer. No, they had both, right? And they're having it in two different places. Then they would proceed to the study hall to study Torah, eating and drinking in the sukkah, afternoon prayer, then the daily afternoon offering, and then partying all night, the celebration of the drawing of the water. So it's a great eyewitness account, Rabbi Yeshua, what it was like in the temple on Sukkot. Okay? But Rabbi Yeshua is also a very cosmopolitan, very, very educated man. He's one of the people, Gemara talks about how you always have to have a certain number of the leadership who know different languages so they can deal with outside rulers. And Rabbi Yeshua is one of those people. And we have a bunch of different stories where Rabbi Yeshua is what's called in the Gemara Nitpala Romaim or Nitpala Goyim, right? He deals with them when they have these kind of polemical questions. Right? So we have quite a few sources here. I brought you a couple of them. Right? Just this one in Nida doesn't tell you so many details. I didn't bring you the questions, but the wise people of Alexandria asked 12 matters of Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania. Three of them were matters of wisdom. Three were matters of agada. Three were matters of ignorance, right? Whatever they were, but he is the person they came to with their questions. Okay? Then the much more common sources are where the emperor or the Roman official comes and asks these questions that are like a little bit needling, like, really, really, you really believe this stuff? Hey, the emperor said to Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania, "I wish to see your God." Rabbi Yeshua said to him, "You cannot see him." The emperor said to him, "I wish to see him." Rabbi Yeshua went and stood the emperor facing the sun in the season of Tammuz in the summer. Rabbi Yeshua said to him, "Look at it." The emperor said to him, "I can't." Rabbi Yeshua said to him, "Now regard to the sun, which is only one of the servants that stand before the Holy One, blessed be he. You say, I can't look at it. Is it not all the more so with regard to the divine presence?" Right? So he uses logic to show him that you can't see God, right? Does it really work? I don't know, but it's interesting, these stories, because they also reflect something that we're going to talk about in a minute, which is that people in the Roman Empire, pagans, are very fascinated by Judaism, okay? For good and for bad. It's a very fascinating topic for them, and that's reflected through these stories. And the third story is a story where you get a sense of Rabbi Yeshua as someone who doesn't take himself so seriously, and he can laugh at himself even while other people are laughing. The daughter of the emperor said to Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania, "You are the epitome of magnificent Torah, but it is stored in an ugly vessel," right? He's known to be a very ugly guy. He said to her, "You may learn the answer from your father's house. In what container do you place wine?" She said to him, "In earthenware vessels," right? "In clay jars." He said to her, "Is it conceivable that everyone stores their wine in earthenware and you also? meaning you're the emperor. You should be fancy. You should place your wine in vessels of silver and gold. She went and placed the wine in vessels of silver and gold, and it spoiled. Of course, that's not good for keeping wine. Rabbi Yoshua said to her, the same is true of Torah. It spoils if it is contained in a handsome person. She asked him, but are there not people who are both good looking and learned in Torah? He said to her, if they were ugly, they would be even more learned. Right? So he's making a little fun of her, a little fun of himself, but he knows how to talk to people. And he uses that knowledge. The picture, of course, is the famous picture of the Arch of Titus and the adversaries, the Romans. But he uses that ability to talk to people, not only to talk to the Romans, but to talk to the Jews. And the last years, it seems, of Rabbi Yoshua's life, there is an uprising or an attempt at an uprising against the Romans. We're post the Great Revolt. The temple's been destroyed. We're not at the Bar Kokhba Revolt yet. There seems to be something in the middle. We don't know, this is exactly what we're gonna talk about now. We don't know for sure what this is, when this is. It could be that this is connected to a revolt that was happening in the diaspora among Jews called the Trajan Revolt, right? Or Pumus Kitos in the time of the Emperor Trajan, 115 to 117 is the time of the revolt. Maybe something spread to the Jews. It could be in the early years of Hadrian. We don't know. What it seems to be about, at least from this story in Bereishit Rabbah, is that the Romans come, they offer to rebuild the temple, but they offer to do it only if it includes kind of a pagan component. So there's this great hope that's then dashed. And they don't know what to do. So here's the story. In the days of Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananiah, the evil kingdom decreed to rebuild the temple. Pappus and Lilianus, two brothers who were later martyred in Luz, set up tables from Akko to Antioch and supplied the pilgrims from the diaspora with silver, gold, and all their needs, right? So everybody's very hopeful. Everybody's coming. Temple's going to be rebuilt. And you have to really understand that what we said last time with Yavne, Meirai Bana Mikdash. Everybody thinks the temple is going to be rebuilt any day now. There's not this feeling of, oh, well, when Mashiach comes, right? Which we say to me now, who knows, at the end of time. They think it's happening any minute now. And it's not a crazy idea. And then they're frustrated by these Samaritans, these Kutim, right? Who go and kind of mess them up with the emperor and say, don't do this. They're going to rebel. And meanwhile, they managed to mess it up by getting the Romans to say, okay, well, it's not going to be like your temple that you really want, right? And they're very frustrated and go down to here. All of the Jewish people were gathered in Beit Rimon, and this is the Beit Rimon Valley. When the king's edict arrived, they began to cry. They sought to rebel against the king. The sages said, let a wise man go to quiet the assembly. We can't have another revolt. We're barely 50 years after the first one. We've just starting to rebuild ourselves. They said, let Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananiah go as he is learning in Torah. Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananiah went and expounded. Now, can you imagine the presence that he must have had to go in front of this mob, which is all fired up and very, very angry and very ready to go do something rash. And he gets them quiet and he tells the story. A lion was devouring prey and a bone got stuck in his throat. It said, I will give a reward to anyone who comes and removes it. An Egyptian heron with a long beak put his beak into the mouth of the lion and extracted the bone. It said to the lion, give me my reward. The lion said to it, go and praise yourself. I went into the mouth of the lion in peace and I came out in peace. There's no greater reward than that. So too, it is enough for us that we have entered into this nation in peace and come out in peace. Okay? And this is a great example of Rabbi Yoshua, who is someone who, as Rav Margolio describes him, he helps his nation in a very difficult time after the destruction of the temple, using his weapons, right, of wisdom and of understanding how to talk to people and of Torah. But we're going to see that the climate is going to change very drastically. And here's where we get to our story of the revolt. I brought you this great picture just because I loved it. This is illustration by a Polish Jewish artist named Arthur Sick, who made a very famous Haggadah which I'm sure a lot of people have seen. And here's Bar Kokhba as this very kind of heroic figure on his horse. And I brought this picture. Why? Because we don't know a lot about Bar Kokhba. And that's why imagining it is very nice, but we don't have a lot of details. The Bar Kokhba revolt is very different than the Great Revolt. People who came to the last series, we talked about the Great Revolt and we talked about Josephus. And people said, well, do we trust Josephus? Is Josephus a traitor? Trust him, don't trust him, traitor, not traitor. He gives us something where we had nothing, right? He gives us a sequence of events, names, dates, places. The Bar Kokhba revolt has no Josephus. There is no historian. Okay? All we have is little fragments here and there, some from the Roman sources, some from the Jewish sources. Very little of it. Very little of it is linear. None of it is linear. Not a lot of details. Plus, realize that most of what we're going to read about the Bar Kokhba revolt is written many years after it takes place and is very colored by the fact that they lost. Okay, the Bar Kokhba revolt, I hope this is not a spoiler for anybody, is a terrible, terrible defeat for the Jewish people. And the rabbis, when they talk about Bar Kokhba, they're seeing that in their mind's eye. And they are not portraying him as a particularly sympathetic character. And for centuries upon centuries, we really didn't know very much. But here's what's happened in the last 60, 70 years, an amazing thing. We have come back to the land of Israel, and the archaeology, the land, has begun to reveal the secrets of the story. And we're going to see that in the cave complexes that were found, in the coins that were found, in the letters from Bar Kokhba that were found, right? Archaeology is going to fill in, not everything, there's still a lot that we don't know. And you're going to hear me say a lot of times, oh, well, it might be this and it might be that, and we're not 100% sure. But it does give us much more than we had before. And the other thing I liked about this picture, like I said, he's this conquering hero on the horse. In fact, he looks very Roman with his helmet, right, and his shield, even with the Star of David on it, very anachronistic, Arthur-sick. That was not the Jewish symbol in the time of Bar Kokhba. It was a menorah. But Bar Kokhba is adopted by the early Zionists as one of these great heroes, right? Like the Maccabees. Bar Kokhba, very similar. Ze'ev Jabotinsky, when he writes the anthem of the Beitar movement, what are the three places he talks about Jewish heroism? Masada, Yodfat, right? From the Great Revolt, those two. Beitar from Bar Kokhba. So that's, he was also adopted, again, not necessarily truthfully, by the early Zionists. So what's our story? What's the backdrop? Okay. Jews are recovering from the destruction of the temple. They are beginning to rebuild. Okay. Trajan, the emperor from 98 to 117, expands the empire, expands it actually. Here, let's understand where we are. Okay. Expands it past, here's Judea. Sorry, that's not a good color. Okay, and Judea is on the edge of the empire. Beyond Judea are the Parthians, right? Sworn enemies of the Romans. Trajan even manages to conquer some of the Parthians. He wants to subdue them. Ultimately, he doesn't succeed and he dies. What's the Jewish situation in the empire? The Jewish population numbers are very high. We have sources that talk about the Jews being 10% of the population of the Roman Empire, which is huge. Okay? And the way most people explain that is that it's not only the Jews, right? We don't have that many Jews. We have a lot of Romans who are either actual converts or are sympathetic to Judaism, are interested in the ideas of Judaism. Okay? They're God-fearers, they call themselves, right? So they're not pagans anymore. They're not really Jews either. They might not go quite so far as taking on everything in Judaism, but they're very sympathetic to Judaism. And we have traces of that, echoes of that in the rabbinic literature, right? We have a fellow who's named Akilos Hager, right? Akila, who is talked about as the nephew of Hadrian, the emperor, who says these are the wisest people and he decides he wants to join them, okay? The flip side, right? The other side of that coin of admiring the Jews is there's also a lot of anti-Semitism. Jews are out there. People know about Jews. And so there's also anti-Semitism. Trajan doesn't seem to have strong feelings one way or another. He dies in 117. He doesn't have any children. And his successor, is a fellow named Hadrian. We happen to know very much what Hadrian looks like because we have lots of statues of him all over the place. If he looked like his statues, he was a nice looking guy. And Hadrian decides he is not going to follow his predecessor in conquering more and more areas. He wants to take the empire as it is, which, as we saw, is rather large, right? Hadrian goes all the way up to England, Hadrian's Wall up in England, and over to Spain. It's a very large empire. And what he wants to do is he wants to focus on keeping the empire at peace. And he's a philosopher, and he wants the empire to all follow the ideas of Hellenism. Hellenism, Romans, right? Going back a few centuries, Alexander the Great. And he wants everybody to live peacefully, but with this common culture, right? So here you have a picture of arches actually in Greece, right? He wants to make everybody be sympathetic to each other, and he'll agree to rebuild local temples, but it has to include certain elements of this larger Hellenistic culture. He travels all over the empire. The question is, what's going to be with the Jews, right? What is he going to do with these strange people that the Romans don't get? You know, why do you always want to be different? Hey, and he, as part of his travels around the empire in the year 130, he visits Judea. Now, it's very unclear what happens here, but what is clear is that the visit very soon afterwards triggers the revolt. Why? Okay, one of the things we know that Hadrian has as an edict is he bans circumcision, Brit Milah, which is something which is very common for Greeks and Romans to ban such a thing because it's mutilating the body. You have the perfection of the body. How can you harm the body? Jews are used to this, but they were always exempted. And the question is, did he this time not exempt the Jews and say, no, you're not allowed to have Brit Milah either? Maybe not. Again, not clear. He comes to Judea, and it seems he plans this new city in the destroyed city of Jerusalem called Aelia Capitolina. Now, there was a long stand. We're going to come back to Aelia Capitolina and this Roman triumphal arch that today's Shaar Shechem, at least one piece of it is. And here is the coin where he creates Aelia Capitolina. There's a long-standing debate about whether the creation of Aelia Capitolina was the cause of the revolt or a consequence of the revolt. When he says, I'm going to create a pagan city, do the Jews go up in arms and then there's the terrible battles of the Bar Kokhba revolt? Or do they start fighting for other reasons, Brit Milah, other things? And then when they are soundly defeated, Hadrian comes along and says, I'm going to create this pagan city. And we have different versions. Roman historian Dio Cassius says it was a cause. A Christian historian named Eusebius says, no, it was the consequence. We really had no way of determining this. But recently, in one of the Bar Kokhba cave complexes, they discovered a coin, an Aelia Capitolina coin, in the Bar Kokhba cave complexes, meaning when the fighters of Bar Kokhba are around, the city of Aelia Capitolina is already here. So it seems it's more of a cause than a consequence, but we don't have any Aelia Capitolina coins that are overstruck with Bar Kokhba coins. So, you know, to create a new kind of coin. So we don't know 100%, but that seems to be more of a proof. And what we do know is that once Hadrian leaves, the Jews start to prepare for battle. And this time they are very well prepared. Before we read the passage, the famous passage from the Roman historian Dio Cassius, just one or two words about the difference between the Great Revolt and the Bar Kokhba Revolt. We already talked about that there's no real historian. But another major difference is that the Jews are very united and very prepared. And when we talked about the Great Revolt, there are all these factions, all these Jewish leaders who hate each other, sometimes assassinate each other, throw each other off of mountains. We don't have that in the Bar Kokhba Revolt. There's one leader, albeit perhaps not a perfect leader, but there's one leader. Everybody's following him. There's one major tactic, and that's creating these underground complexes to hide out in guerrilla warfare. We don't have a whole division, right? The other thing that's an important difference is that we're talking about religious issues as opposed to only independence and sovereignty. And we're going to see that when we talk about the decrees, the religious decrees against the Jews. But let's see what Dio Cassius has to say. So he's a Roman historian who lives less than 100 years after the events. So in that sense, he's reliable, but in the sense of he's a Roman, he doesn't always understand what's going on, less reliable. He also doesn't tell us that much. So here we see at Jerusalem, we're talking about Hadrian, founded a city in place of the one which had been raised to the ground, naming it Aelia Capitolina. So here he says that's the cause, right? And on the site of the temple of the god, he raised a new temple to Jupiter. This brought on a war of no slight importance nor brief duration, for the Jews deemed it intolerable that foreign races should be settled in their city and foreign religious rites planted there. So long as Hadrian was close by in Egypt and in Syria, they remained quiet, save insofar as they purposely made a proquality such weapons as they were called upon to furnish, right? They wrecked the weapons that they gave for the Romans in order that the Romans might reject them and they themselves might have the use of them. But when he went farther away, they openly revolted. Now here's the part that's important to us. To be sure, they did not dare try conclusions with the Romans in the open field, but they occupied the advantageous positions in the country and strengthened them with mines and walls in order that they might have places of refuge whenever they should be hard pressed and might meet together unobserved underground. And they pierced these subterranean passages from above at intervals to let in air and light. Okay, so Dio Cassius tells us about cave complexes. We know about them also in rabbinic literature, but it's only in the 1960s and 1970s that we start finding them. Okay, where do we find them? Mostly in the lowlands of Judea, the areas around near Beit Shemesh. We're going to look at the map in a minute. What do we talk about when we talk about cave complexes? Usually what this is they take existing underground installations, right? A cistern, a mikveh, a columbarium for doves, all these things in the lowlands, the rocks are soft and they would dig all kinds of basements and different kinds of installations, and they would expand them to be hideout cave complexes, okay? Usually with an entrance that was hidden under a building, under a tree, something that was difficult to find, okay? You came down and all these narrow passageways, twists and turns so that if any Roman soldier would follow them, it could be picked off one by one. And eventually you come to a larger, more open chamber. Today you can go and crawl through these things. It's really unbelievable to go and see them. And here you have places that are hideouts so that soldiers could wait till the Romans appear and then guerrilla warfare, attack them and quickly run back inside. And like I said, now we are finding them, okay? Where are these caves? So far, we found 125 sites with more than 300 complexes in, you know, all together in these sites. Most of them are within existing communities, right? They're within, they're underneath the synagogue, they're by the mikveh, they're near somebody's house, right? And they dig these out. Now, what does that tell us? That tells us that there's universal agreement in that community to join the revolt, because it's a small town. Everybody knows everybody's business. If one person says, I'm not in on this and goes to tell the Romans, that's the end of that, right? So everybody has to be joining together in this battle. Now, these are mostly found in Yehuda, in Judea. And that's the cave here on the left is from a cave called the Te'omim cave, not too far from Beit Shemesh, right? Bats live there, but it's also part of a hideout cave. But what about the rest of the country, right? Did the rest of the country participate in this revolt? We don't hear so much about it, but here again is where archaeology steps in. In the Lower Galilee, in the last 30, 40 years, caves have been discovered. And this is one of them on the right here. This is a cave complex in a place called Ruma, not too far from Tzipori, okay? It's exactly the same kind of thing, right? Tunnels, narrow tunnels opening up to larger passageways. We don't know 100% if the Galilee was involved in the revolt, but they certainly seem to have been sympathetic and to have been prepared, right? So where are we talking about? Let's just look at our map for a second. Judea, definitely many, many, many cave complexes. The headquarters of Bar Kokhba here in Beitar. Okay, we also hear about Herodium, which is not on this map, also caves that are hideout caves in the Judean desert, but we also have caves up here in the Lower Galilee, okay? And that's one of the fascinating things that archaeology is really helping us to figure out questions that we couldn't know from the sources. Now, these cave complexes are fascinating because we also have a lot of sources about them, okay, from the rabbis. And until we found them, we really didn't have such a sense of what they were talking about because the sources are kind of obscure, right? So we have a famous, famous source in the Gemara in Shabbat that talks about how you're not allowed to wear sandals that have nails on the bottom on Shabbat. why not? So then we have this story. It's kind of a strange story. It doesn't really fit with the halacha, but we're not going to go into that now. What's important for us is the story. What is the reason you can't? Said Shmuel, it was at the end of the period of persecution, the time of Shmad, and some fugitives were hiding in a cave. They proclaimed, he who would enter, let him enter. He who would go out, let him not go out, right? We don't want anyone to give away where we are. The sandal of one of them became reversed. So they thought that one of them had gone out and been seen by the enemies, who would now fall upon them. Thereupon, they pressed against each other and they killed each other more than their enemy slew of them. So there's this panic because they think that somebody has infiltrated the cave based on the footprints on the floor. Very frightening, no escape, and they panic and they kill each other. So we have sources like that. We also have a very, like, one little sentence in the Gemara in Yevamot. It's talking about, and so many of the things in the Gemara that are, the Gemara is not history, right? It tells us things, by the way. So by the way, a woman comes and she says that her husband is no longer alive and therefore she's free to remarry. What is the story she says? Tashma ishnu aleinu bayit, ishnu aleinu me'ara. They set our house on fire, or they set our cave on fire. Now, the on fire is not actually correct. They ishnu, they created smoke. They smoked us out. What does that mean? That means the Romans show up and they can't get into these caves. So they make the caves into a death trap, because you can see the narrow, narrow entranceway. And this is one method that they use to kill off the rebels, by smoking them out. But you can see this one tiny little throwaway line in the Gemara is giving us a whole world of this story. Now, caves were very dangerous, but they also could save people. Of course, the soldiers, but not only. And we have another fascinating halacha, talks about a very, very difficult law, right, that says that if a wife of a Kohen, a wife of a priest, is raped, she cannot return to her husband. Okay, and when the enemies would come and conquer a city, likelihood is that women were raped. And we have a very significant halacha, which says if there is a machboa, a hiding place, a cave complex in the city, we don't need proof that the women went to the complex. We just need to know the complex exists. And if the complex exists, they are permitted to go back to their husbands. That's a fascinating thing. That means that this was an insurance to make sure that the women were protected, that the women were safe. So it shows up in our sources, but until we saw them, it really was hard to understand what we're talking about. Now, a major character that we're talking about here, of course, is Bar Kokhba. But who is this guy? We don't even know very much about him. Okay, we hear about him in our sources, the Midrash and Eicha Rabbah. Rabbi Akiva beheld Bar Koziba. Koziba, he's Koziba, right? And then we're going to see another source where he says to him, he's a Kochav, Darach Kochav Me'Yakov. Is his name Koziba? Is his name Kochava? What is his name, and who is he, and what's his personality? And we have this very harsh story, right, that talks about how Bar Kokhba, or Bar Koziba, as the rabbis call him, and realize Koziba Kazav, he's a liar, he's a false hope. Okay, how did he choose his soldiers? He had with him 200,000 men with an amputated finger. The sages sent him a message. How long will you continue to make the men of Israel blemished? He said, so he would make them cut off their finger as a test of bravery. So they said, you can't do that. He said, okay, you have to ride on a horse and uproot a tree as you're riding along. Okay? Also, not exactly a very simple thing, but we really know very little about his personality. And then suddenly, unbelievably, in 1961, as I'm going to tell you the story in a minute, amazing, amazing discovery of a cave, which became known as the Cave of Letters, Ma'arat HaIgrot, where we discovered letters that were written by a fellow named Shimon ben Kospa. Okay, can you guys see it here? Shimon ben Kospa, Kaf Vav Samach Bet. Hey, not Koziba, like Kazav, not Kochva, like a star, like a Kochav, but his real name was Kospa, which makes it easy to play with both those things. Rabbi Akiva thinks he's a star. Others think he's a Kazav. He's a frustration. He's a lie. But his real name is Kospa. Now, what's the story? How were these found? Okay, in the early 60s, in 1960, to be more exact. Okay, all kinds of things started reaching the antiquities market from the Judean desert. And archaeologists understood, Israeli archaeologists understood that Bedouin were finding all kinds of places that should not have been accessible to them and plundering them. A group of really important archaeologists, among them Yigael Yadin, who's in the picture you see here, came to the Israeli government and said, listen, these caves are very hard to access, but we really need to do a survey, like a lightning fast, super amazing survey. We're going to bring in the top archaeologists, and we need the army to help us because you can see how inaccessible this is. Caves that were south of En Gedi, because north of En Gedi was Jordan, right? And we're going to divide it into four quadrants. Each one is going to be have an archaeologist in charge of it, and we're going to see what we can find. And the army agrees, and the government agrees, and they allocate the resources for this, which is not so simple in 1960, but they do it. Yadin gets assigned to what he thinks is the least promising quadrant. In the end, he finds the most exciting. There were two sensational discoveries that came out of this cave excavation. One was caves that were from the Chalcolithic period, right, prehistoric period, which had all kinds of ritual objects, a place called Nachal Mishmar. But what's important for us is the Cave of Letters. And that's what you're seeing here, this crazy cave, where they discovered the remains of people who had fled here during the Bar Kokhba revolt. And we're going to see some of them later. But the most important thing they discovered were letters signed by Shimon ben Kospa, or as he otherwise signs himself, Shimon Nisi Israel, Shimon the President of Israel. And suddenly we're getting a picture of the man from himself, right? He's writing the letters. So we get a sense of who he is. And on the one hand, we do find out that, like the rabbis write, he's not a pushover. He's very tough. And he writes about punishing people who are shirking. He writes about putting people in chains. He is not an easy character. On the other hand, what the rabbis don't tell us about so much, he's very concerned about religiosity. He makes sure that his soldiers have the four species for Sukkot. He's very concerned about Shemitah and Truma and Maaser. He doesn't write his letters on Shabbat. He's very concerned about idolatry. So we get a fuller picture, not a very full picture, but a fuller picture of the man. And it was really one of the most spectacular archaeological discoveries. We're going to come back to it a little bit later. But now let's get to our main figure, Rabbi Akiva. Okay, 45 minutes in, but here we are. Okay, everybody knows stories about Rabbi Akiva. I wanted to point out a couple of things. First of all, we have various versions of his late beginnings. Everybody agrees that as a young man, he doesn't study Torah. So does he come to the realization that he needs to study by himself, as we have here in Avot de Rabbi Natan, right, where he stands by the mouth of the well and he sees that the stone is worn away, right? And he says, maybe my heart could also be worn away and I could go and learn Torah. We hear about it with his wife, Rachel. She convinces him. Either way, he comes to Torah later in life. And two things about that, right? First of all, take a look at the second paragraph here. This is the version from Avot de Rabbi Natan. I will go and study at least one section of Torah. He went directly to a schoolhouse and he and his son, he has a son already, began reading from a child's tablet. Rabbi Akiva took hold of one end and his son of the other. The teacher wrote Aleph and Bet and he learned them Aleph and Taf and he learned them the book of Leviticus and he learned it. He went on studying till he learned the whole Torah. Okay. Think of the humility of this man. He's 40 years old and he's sitting with his son on the floor in the gan, learning how to read and write. Okay, that's incredible. But the second thing that's incredible, and this would be familiar to anyone who started learning Torah a little later in life, someone who was a Baal Tshuva, and it's such a powerful thing. Okay? He went and sat before Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua, my masters, he said, reveal the sense of the Mishnah to me. When they told him one halacha, he went off to reason with himself. This Aleph, what was it written for? That Bet, what was it written for? This teaching, what was it uttered for? He kept coming back, kept inquiring until he reduced his teaching to silence. And that's the beauty of someone who comes to Torah as an adult. You learn these stories when you're 5, 6, and you say, I know that story. He didn't know that story. And he analyzes it as an adult in an incredibly deep way when he sees it for the very first time. And that's an unbelievable gift that Rabbi Akiva has. And we know that Rabbi Akiva is Doresh Otiyota. He's always looking, well, why is it written this way? Why is it written that way? He doesn't take anything for granted. Okay. Rabbi Akiva has all of the oral law transmitted through him, through his students, in a time where so much is missing, is lost, he transmits to his students, and his students carry on that tradition. And I'll just bring you one other source here from Avot to Rabbi Natan. Rabbi Akiva is called a sealed vault, Otsar Balum. Rabbi Akiva was like a worker who took his basket and went out to gather. He found wheat, he put in his basket, he found barley, he put in his basket, he found beans, he found lentils. When he came home, he would separate the wheat into one pile, the barley into one pile. So it was with Rabbi Akiva. He organized the whole Torah into identifiable categories. So it's not only that he has an inquisitive mind, but he has a very well-organized and categorical mind. Okay, and we have this great statement. He goes to meet a famous sage and says, "You are Rabbi Akiva, whose name has spread, Akiva ben Yosef, whose name has spread from one end of the world to the other," right? So he becomes very well known, even though he starts very late in life. And he has a very, very deep and abiding love, both for God and for the Torah. Okay, so two stories that I brought you here. The Torah story is part of the larger story that we're going to see of his martyrdom. And that's the story here on the right. Once the wicked government issued a decree forbidding Jews to study and practice Torah, Pappus ben Yehuda came and found Rabbi Akiva publicly bringing gatherings together and occupying himself with the Torah. He said, "Akiva, are you not afraid of the government?" Rabbi Akiva replied, "I will explain to you with a parable. A fox was once walking alongside a river. He saw fish going in swarms from one place to another. He said to them, 'From what are you fleeing?' They replied, 'From the nets cast for us by men.' The fox said to them, 'Would you like to come on the dry land so you and I can live together?' They replied, 'Are you the one that they call the cleverest of animals? You aren't clever, you're foolish. If we are afraid in the element in which we live, how much more in the element in which we would die? Fish can't live out of water. The Jewish people cannot live without Torah." And that's Rabbi Akiva, so connected to the Torah, cannot picture a life without Torah. He also cannot picture a life without God, and where God is not exclusive to the Jewish people. And that's the source here. I'm not going to read it right now, but where he talks about Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs. And he says, "My beloved is mine and I am his. Dodi Liva Ani Lo." The non-Jews come and they say, "Well, what is your beloved like?" And he describes, you know, she describes her beloved in the Song of Songs. And they say, "Okay, well, we also want to be part of it." "No, no, no. I am my beloved and my beloved is mine. Nobody else. Exclusive relationship. You, Hadrian, you want to come and you want to build a temple and you want to be part of our religion? No. It's only between us and God." And that's Rabbi Akiva's approach. And the other thing that's very important to understand about Rabbi Akiva is that he cannot picture a world where Roman values are supreme. Roman values like the value of gladiator fights, and this is the amphitheater in Beit Guvrin, where human life is so worthless that it provides fodder for games, right? And Rabbi Akiva says in Pirkei Avot, "Beloved is man, chaviv adam, Chenivra Bitzelem, for he was created in the image of God." He doesn't say Jews. Later he talks about Jews, but man, all people are created in the image of God, especially beloved as he was made known to him that he had been created in the image of God. How could somebody who sees that as the supreme value coexist with a people that says, well, some people are important and other people are not important? So Rabbi Akiva joining the Bar Kokhba revolt is a very logical idea, because it's something that where Torah is being forbidden, the Romans are coming along and saying, we want these values and not those values. He believes in Bar Kokhba, okay? And of course, he joins the fight, whether physically or just supporting it. And we have this fascinating statement. I have it in a few places. Here it is in Yevamot. It was said that Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs of disciples and they all died at the same time because they did not treat each other with respect, right? And many people suggest that this is kind of code saying that they were involved in this revolt. They were soldiers. It doesn't say it outright, okay? And the world remained desolate. That's what we'll talk about next time, until Rabbi Akiva came to our masters in the south and taught the Torah to them. He believes in Bar Kokhba. He brings his students to follow Bar Kokhba. And look at the second source here, and that's what I was mentioning before. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said, "My teacher Akiva taught a star has come forth from Jacob. Darach Kochav Me Yaakov means Kuzba has come forth from Jacob. Kuzba instead of Kokhba, a reference to Bar Kokhba." But not everybody agreed, right? Not everybody agreed that this was a prudent thing to do. Here we are less than 70 years after the destruction of the temple. We're going into another military adventure. This is a good idea. And there are many who did not agree. Okay. We saw before Rabbi Akiva says that Bar Kokhba is the Messiah. Yochanan ben Torta says grass is going to grow out of your cheeks and the Messiah is not going to come. You'll be in the ground for a long time pushing up daisies before the Messiah comes. And there are others who spoke out even more strongly. We have the story here in Avodah Zarah on the right. Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma fell ill. Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion went to visit him. Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion is one of the Harugei Manchut, one of the martyrs who's killed for teaching Torah in public. Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma said to him, Hanina, my brother, do you not know that this nation has been given reign by a decree from heaven? The proof is that Rome has destroyed God's temple and burned his sanctuary and killed his pious ones, and it still exists. And we're going to see this discussion next week when we talk about those people who were broken by the power of the Romans and who couldn't believe that that a just God would put people like that in charge unless they were supposed to be in charge. And that's where Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma says, these guys are in charge, and we have to follow that decree. And he goes on, he says, I heard that you sit and engage in Torah study and convene assemblies in public and have a Torah scroll placed in your lap. What's the matter with you? Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion said to him, heaven will have mercy. Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma said, I am saying reasonable matters to you, and you say to me, heaven will have mercy? Well, what's the matter with you? How are you thinking? I wonder if the Romans will not burn both you and your Torah scroll by fire, which of course is what happens to Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion. Very, very terrible end. But you can see that not everybody jumped on this bandwagon that Rabbi Akiva is saying that Bar Kokhba is the Messiah and we have to fight. There are people, and this is throughout Jewish history, who say, no, lie low. It'll blow over. It'll be over. Meanwhile, we have to just survive. The battles continue in the beginning. The rebels are successful, but the Romans always have more resources. The Romans bring more and more legions. Here we have symbols of the 10th legion on the right here, the Fritensis, the 6th legion, Ferrata. 10th legion is based in Jerusalem. The 6th legion was based up in the Jezreel Valley near what was Megiddo. We think that there were about 50,000 Roman soldiers who are involved in the battle here. Huge, huge, huge numbers. Meanwhile, the rebels keep on going. They mint coins. Right? Coins are a sign of sovereignty. What do they put on the coins? Well, it shows us a lot about who they are and what they are believing in. First of all, the writing. If you look at the writing, you can see it's not the Hebrew we use today. It's the ancient Hebrew. It's the Ketav Ivri Atik, right? Saying we're going to go back to the days, the glory days of David and Solomon, right? The symbols are symbols that are connected to the land of Israel, like palm trees and grapes, but also connected to the temple. Okay, here's the facade of the temple. You have instruments from the temple. You have here the lulav and etrog. And the, what's right written there is what their goal is. L'cheirut Yerushalayim, for the freedom of Jerusalem. L'geulat Yisrael, for the redemption of Israel. Right? And this is telling us what they're hoping is going to happen. Now, it also tells us that they're not in such good shape because these coins are very crudely and sloppily made. You can even see it over here, and I'm not such a big expert. Right? They're just doing it very quickly. They don't have resources. Ultimately, they are not strong enough. The Romans come, they conquer their headquarters. I brought you two pictures here, one from the amazing underground tunnels discovered in Herodion in eastern Gush Etzion, Herod's palace that the Bar Kokhba rebels took over, and they dug an enormous underground complex, okay, and something that's less well known because you can't really visit it, Beitar, right? We know the modern Beitar, about 15 minutes from Jerusalem, ultra-Orthodox city. Across the street is the Arab village of Batir. And that was where Bar Kokhba's headquarters were. But Beitar falls to Jerusalem. Very, very terrible end that is reported in our various sources. Okay, I'm a little pressed for time, so I'm not going to read through it, but you guys have the sources. Basically, Bar Kokhba only surrenders because he has to, because the person who has been praying for him to survive is Rabbi Elazar HaModa'i, and he distrusts him at a certain point. He kills him, and that, according to Eicha Rabba, is why he is defeated. You can look at it different ways, but it seems clear that at least the rabbis are saying the only way Bar Kokhba could be defeated is if God is not helping him anymore, if nobody is praying for him. The aftermath is terrible. There's an enormous massacre. Many, many people are killed. People are crucified, right? We hear about the dead of Beitar, that the Romans don't allow them to be buried. And finally, when they're allowed to be buried, they institute this blessing of Hatova Hametiv. We have an eyewitness from Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. He says there were 400 synagogues in the city City of Beitar, and everyone were 400 teachers of children, and each one had 400 pupils. And when the enemy entered, they pierced them with their staves and burned and prevailed and wrapped them in their scrolls and burnt them with fire. Jews are murdered. Jews are crucified. Jews are sold into slavery. Okay? Slave markets are filled with Jews. Some of the survivors escape. Okay, some of the survivors escape to other caves in the desert. And that's where we get back to our story of the Cave of Letters. They escape to the desert. It seems they go through the nearest kind of desert wadis out towards the Judean desert, and they hide out in caves. What do they take with them? They take with them things that show that they're planning on returning home. Okay, and the most poignant thing they take with them is keys. These are keys that were found in the caves. Okay, took what you thought was going to bring you home one day. But they don't go home because we found bones, skulls in the cave. Hey, we found remnants of what they brought with them, which show us that it was all strata of society that were involved in the revolt. This dish was found like this, by the way. Yigael Yadin says it looked better than anything his grandmother had ever packed up. Hey, but they're very wealthy. You have fabric that's colored with very expensive dyes. All kinds of people were involved in this revolt. And ultimately, they're caught there as well. The Romans institute all kinds of decrees against the Jews. And we hear about this in all different places in rabbinic literature. Decrees against circumcision and keeping Shabbat and teaching Torah and blowing the shofar and wearing tefillin and tzitzit. And we have the disagreement that we saw earlier in Beit Nitza and Lod. Do you have to sacrifice your life for any mitzvah? Or only for those three very significant ones? And there are two different opinions. And one opinion says, in the time of Shmad, in the time of the decrees, you sacrifice your life for anything. Right? And this is, unfortunately, a message that has continued throughout Jewish history because we've had so much martyrdom. Rabbi Akiva is captured as well for teaching Torah in public and probably for his role in the rebellion in general. And here's where we get to the end of that story that we started with the mashal of the fish. Rabbi Akiva says, with all thy soul, this is in Brachot, and it so often happens in the Gemara, it's such a fascinating thing. This is, by the way, a discussion of saying Shema and what do the words of the Shema mean? And suddenly we come out with this story that you read it and you just can't catch your breath. Okay? What does it mean when it says Bechol Nafshecha, right? You should love God, Vahavta Hashem Elokecha, Bechol Levavcha, with all your heart, Bechol Nafshecha, with all your soul. Rabbi Akiva says, with all your soul, even if he takes your soul. When Rabbi Akiva was taken for execution, it was the hour for the recital of the Shema. And while they combed his flesh with iron combs, he was accepting upon himself the kingship of heaven. His disciples said to him, our teacher, even to this point, he said to them, all my days I have been troubled by this verse, which all your soul, which I interpret even if he takes your soul. I said, when shall I have the opportunity of fulfilling this? Now that I have the opportunity, shall I not fulfill it? He prolonged the word echad until he expired while saying it. Abba Kol went forth and said, happy are you, Akiva, that your soul has departed with the world. Word echad. It's an unbelievable story. Now, when we hear Rabbi Akiva saying Shema in his martyrdom, we say, oh, of course he was saying Shema. That's what people say when they're about to die. No, they say this because Rabbi Akiva said it. Hey, he is the first one who associates Shema, Kiddush Hashem, proclaiming God's unity at the moment of death, at the moment of sanctifying God's name of Kiddush Hashem. And unfortunately, many martyrs have followed in his footsteps through the Inquisition and the Shoah, and unfortunately, all the tragedies of Jewish history. Rabbi Akiva has been their model. Now, I'm not going to talk about the aftermath of the revolt now because I am out of time. I'm going to do it next time, but I don't want to finish with this. I want to finish with one more thing. So don't be shocked that we're skipping these. We're going to come back to them next time. Okay. And this is Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is the eternal optimist, maybe because his life is so complicated. And here we have this incredible, tragic, terrible ending to the story. We're going to see next time that the generation afterwards is really a generation of survivors. And yet, Rabbi Akiva always looks at the positive. And here's where we have this famous story from the end of the Gemara in Makot. Hey, two stories, really. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Yoshua, and Rabbi Akiva were walking along the road, and they heard the sound of the multitudes of Rome. the sages began weeping. Rabbi Akiva was laughing. They said, why are you laughing? Rabbi Akiva said, why are you weeping? They said to him, these Gentiles who bow to idols and burn incense to idols dwell securely and tranquilly, and our house is burnt by fire. Shall we not weep? Rabbi Akiva said to them, that's why I'm laughing. If for those who violate his will, they are rewarded, right? For those who perform his will, all the more so. He sees this terrible, Rasha Vitovlo, evil people are being rewarded. And he understands from that that good people will be even more rewarded. And the second part of the story, even more famous part of the story, on another occasion, they were ascending to Jerusalem. When they arrived at Mount Scopus, they rent their garments. When they arrived at the Temple Mount, they saw a fox that emerged from the site of the Holy of Holies, right? The temple has been destroyed and a fox is coming out. They began weeping and Rabbi Akiva was laughing. Why are you laughing? Why are you weeping? We are weeping because in the place that it's written, a non-priest who approaches shall die and foxes walk in it and we shall not weep. And Rabbi Akiva said to them, that is why I'm laughing. And he gives them this seemingly complicated drusha, right? He says, brings a verse from the book of Isaiah that links two prophecies, Uriah the priest and Zechariah ben Yeverechia. How are they connected? The Uriah is the first temple period, Zechariah is the second temple period. Rather, the fulfillment of the prophecy of Zechariah is dependent on the fulfillment of the prophecy of Uriah. What does Uriah say? Tzion sadeh techerash, Zion shall be plowed as a field. What does Zechariah say? There shall yet be elderly men and women sitting in the streets of Jerusalem. Until the prophecy of Uriah was fulfilled, I was afraid that the prophecy of Zechariah would not be fulfilled. Now that the prophecy of Uriah was fulfilled, it is evident that the prophecy of Zechariah remains valid. The sage said to him, Akiva nichamtanu, Akiva Nichamtanu. Akiva, you have comforted us. You know that this is not the end of the story. We are in the middle of the story and so much more is yet to come. And you go to Caesarea. There's no more Romans there. There are the words of Rabbi Akiva that are there. So we will come back to the aftermath of the revolt next time. Let's see what questions we have. And if anybody has other questions, let's see, go back to the top. Okay, Nitza sounds like a woman. Today it would be a woman's name. I'm not sure if then. We were in the area of Chorbat Midras. Cool, so cool. Midras, how big is Midras? It's big, but the cave is not big. Hananya, okay, Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananya. I know, it looks a little confusing. Today Christian theologians are interested in Judaism, yes. Okay, Rabbi Yoshua is the Rabbi Yoshua. There are other Rabbi Yoshuas in the Gemara, but Rabbi Yoshua Stam, you correct me if I'm wrong, Rabbi Kalman, but I'm pretty sure that Rabbi Yoshua Stam, certainly in the Mishnah, is Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananya. He doesn't need a last name.
Correct. Every Rabbi Yoshua in the Gemara is Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananya. If it's Rabbi Yoshua ben Netanel, something it'll say who it is. But if it doesn't say, then it's Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananya.
All right, Rabbi Yoshua is like Cher. He doesn't need a last name. Okay, could it be that many of the 10% of Jews were really Christians? So that's where we get to the interesting we'll talk about next time when Judaism is defeated or people feel Judaism is defeated in the Bar Kokhba revolt, they're disillusioned and they turn to Christianity. But at the time of Trajan, Christianity is not so big yet. It's still a very underground religion. Okay, climb through the tunnels, not easy for a fully grown man. I would agree. Okay, shofar blowing, echoing the caves, originated in the Bar Kokhba caves. Very interesting. I don't know anybody who writes about that, but it sounds very possible. There are all kinds of stories that people associate. For example, that story we read in the Haggadah, right? Some people say, well, how did they not know that it was time for Kriyat Shema? Didn't they see that the sun had come up? No, because they were in a cave because they were hiding out from the Romans. So we have a lot of stories that connect those two things. Okay, the story with the Sandal Misumar, yes, very interesting. Was the all idea of a Roman ideology. Also, why are you wearing this Roman garment? There are other different things. Okay, Elisha ben Abuya, we're going to talk about next time. Is there a tradition that Rabbi Akiva is descended from Roman converts? Rabbi Meir has that tradition. I don't know that tradition about Rabbi Akiva. I could be wrong. I don't remember it. I would have to look it up. Was Rabbi Akiva involved in the war physically or ideologically? I would doubt physically. He's an old man by this point, right? But I think definitely in terms of encouraging his students to join, I don't think he was fighting. Okay, the timeline was in the first session, and I think that is accessible to everybody. And anything else you would like, you are welcome to write me, and I will be happy to send you anything. Okay, they were short men then. Thank you. Who was that, Paula? Oh, Roberta. Thank you, everyone. Other questions? Any other questions, anyone?
No, Yashikoa, thank you. It was wonderful.
Thank you. Just
Barbara.
A reminder, next week it'll be 8 o'clock at this time in lunch food. So it'll be Purim. And so, you know, Shuli will be back in 2 weeks, not Shir next week. The Parsha Shir that we normally have, that we have every Thursday night, we will have that next week. Tonight, Yaakov Trump from Young Israel of Cedarhurst and Lawrence will be giving the Shir, but we will have the Shir next week too. But we won't have this Shir. Next week we'll resume, please God, in 2 weeks. And Sunday, in addition to Rabbi Liebtag's Shir at 11:15, Rabbi Joshua Berman will be giving a Shir on biblical criticism, a one-time Shir, how an academic Bible scholar deals with issues of biblical criticism. So he just wrote a book, Animami. Maybe some of you have seen the book published by...
Excellent.
So Rabbi Berman has agreed he'll be giving a Shir. That will be right after Rabbi Liebtag's Shir. We have a few minute break, 11:15, Rabbi Liebtag on Purim, and 12:30, his Shir. And then all our regular Shirim next week, except for this Shir, which we'll resume in 2 weeks. But if anybody had any last minute questions, speak up now or forever hold your breath, or at least for a couple weeks. And thank everybody. Be well. A Shabbat Shalom. Those who can make it this evening, we look forward to learning with you. Everybody should be well and have a great day. And thank you.
Thank you. And happy Purim, everybody.
Happy Purim and Shabbat Shalom. And thank you very much.
Happy Purim.
Happy Purim.
Was there an official Sanhedrin at the time?
Certainly, according to our sources, yes. Right? According to our sources, the Sanhedrin goes through the time of the Amoraim and is only stopped in 5th century or so. Okay?
Right.
There are scholars who suggest that perhaps not, or how powerful it was, but certainly according to our sources, there is Sanhedrin.
Is there any recorded opinion of what they felt about Bar Kokhba and the revolution?
Well, like I said, we have differences of opinion, and we don't have anything that is, the Gemara never gives you, this is the policy, right? This is the official policy. But you have little pieces here and there, like Yochanan ben Torto says, I don't believe in this. Or Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma says, are you crazy? Right? So it's unclear. But the fact that these guys are singled out, I think, would imply that others did, if not actively, passively go along with it.
There's nothing, right? nothing in the sense of like Nimru or Nimnu Vigamru or anything of that nature.
No. And in fact, we have, like I said, very fractional little pieces here and there about Bar Kokhba. What I think is very fascinating, a colleague of mine, David Brofsky, said this once, you think about how devastating this story was and how little it appears in the Gemara. Right? That tells you the Gemara, this is not the point of what the Gemara is trying to do, right? It appears derech agav here and there, but it does not take the place that you would imagine it should take, considering how terrible it was, right? And that I think is an important note to make.
Is there any opinion where the Sanhedrin was during it, what city they were in?
At this point, they're still in the south. They're still in Yavne, or maybe Lod Bnei Brak, right? The Gemara talks about Yavne and then Usha. Usha is in the north. Usha is already in the post Bar Kokhba story, the rebuilding after Bar Kokhba. So we're still in the south. Okay, we haven't moved up north, but that you're going to have to wait till next time.
Wonderful lecture. Thank you.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Okay. Shuli,
will the...
Yes.
The PowerPoint, your PowerPoint today will be posted on the...
I'm not posting the PowerPoint, but there are source sheets. Rabbi Kalman, you want to explain how they're getting the source sheets? Because I don't know.
Yeah, they're already posted on the website. They're both the source sheet, but not the PowerPoint themselves. That's okay. But Julia, we do the from last week and this week, the actual, you know, the timelines and the Gemaras that are quoted, they're both on up on the program page. We go to the website, torahmotion.org, and, you know, go to this, each program has its own page. So you'll see it there, all the sources. And then you can click there to listen to the audio, the video, and then recordings from everything. That's the easiest way. You go to the program you want and click on the audio. I mean, there are a few ways how to get to that, but so that's where the sources are posted.
Yeah.
I hope that's
okay.
Clear.
Thank you, everyone.
For for good reasons, whatever. We don't have the actual, you know, PowerPoint, you know, presentation, but just the sources
thank
themselves.
You.
Okay. Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you again, Julie. Be well, and we'll see you later.